Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
So, how you doing? You tired yet? From American Public Media, this is Market Times. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is 10 May today, Wednesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So it was a very specific kind of tired I was talking about up in the open just now. I mean, we all know that spending by or on behalf of consumers accounts for something near 70% of this entire economy. So when I ask you if you're tired, what I really want to know is how much longer are you going to be able to take all this inflation? Prices up 4.9% year over year, as we learned from this morning's Consumer Price Index. And yes, sure, that is well below the 9% we saw last summer, and things are trending the right way, so stipulated. But it's been a long time now prices have been elevated, and at some point, the question has to be asked of how long until consumers just aren't going to be able to take it anymore. As Marketplace's Abri Menashor reports to get us going, the answer to that question is kind of complicated.
Inflation wears you down, and in some places it is starting to show.
We're approaching historical highs in terms of revolving credit growth.
Corey Tarlow is a senior equity research analyst at Jefferies. We're putting more on our credit cards. In January, the growth in revolving credit year to year was 15.6%, according to Jefferies' calculations.
The last time that it was anywhere close to that was in August of 1996.
At the same time, we are saving less. The savings rate was 9% pre-pandemic. It's about 5% now.
If you think about how that's manifesting in terms of consumer behavior, well, it means that consumers are gravitating much more toward what they need and away from what they want.
We're going to Walmart and the dollar store more and buying less per visit. We're buying more generics over name brands, Tarlow says. Retailers have been blasting out promotional discounts to lure in consumers.
This is the highest increase that I've seen in the last 3 years in terms of promotions.
And yet, inflation is still moderately, stubbornly high.
The fact that consumers are proving more sensitive to higher prices will help bring down inflation itself, but that it's not sufficient.
Preston Caldwell is chief U.S. economist for Morningstar. He says one reason we are still paying more and more for things is because for a lot of things, we still can.
If you have wages go up in line with product prices, a consumer's real income is unchanged, and there's no reason for them to pull back spending necessarily.
Caldwell says that while at first inflation was way higher than wage growth, the two are more in line now. So if we get raises to afford higher prices and then the prices rise and then we get more raises, we're just in this awful inflation loop. So how do you fix that? Well, it is not pretty, but one way is for the labor market to cool.
When people have jobs, they're much less concerned about rising prices.
Michael Zadinik is an economist at S&P Global Market Intelligence.
If and when the labor market turns, these price increases that we've seen the last year are going to weigh on consumer spending really hard.
And he says, really quickly. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If this is Wednesday, it must be another day that traders didn't care about the debt limit. oh, look, it is Wednesday. And oh, look, they still didn't care. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We touched on this a little bit yesterday, the regional differences in this economy, that how people live and work depends in very large part on where they live and work. Yesterday, it was Savannah Marr and inflation in the Mountain West. Today, it's practicing medicine in the rural Northeast. Dr. Eric Henderson is an orthopedic oncology surgeon at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center there in Lebanon, New Hampshire. Dr. Henderson, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
For those perhaps unfamiliar with medicine as a field, what exactly is it that you do?
I am an orthopedic surgeon by trade. I did a fellowship in oncology, and so I care for patients who have primary bone and soft tissue cancers, which are known as sarcomas, and then for patients who have cancers that metastasize to bone.
So talk to me about who your patients are then. Who comes to see you?
I am as likely to see a biotech entrepreneur as a dairy farmer. And so my patients run the gamut, and some of them drive up to 4 hours to be here. And as my former boss said, 85% of the people in the U.S. Live within 5 minutes of a CVS, and we care for the other 15%.
Yeah. So let's do a little nuts and bolts before we actually get into the reason we called you, which is sort of the practice of medicine in a rural environment, which after the pandemic and all the challenges medicine has had, has to be a special challenge. But let me ask you a couple of basics. First of all, staffing. Do you have enough people working for you? Can you find people to help you do orthopedic oncology?
We have 1,800 job openings right now for our health system, and we have about 13,000 total employees, and so we have openings for about 15% of our workforce.
That doesn't seem, I mean, for the people who are there, that doesn't seem sustainable.
Well, you know, the magic trick is that every day we show up to work and we're able to stick the landing for high complexity care. But the problem is we have become highly reliant on traveling nurses and traveling staff. And you're right, that is not sustainable.
Technology has come into play in medicine in this pandemic like we haven't really ever seen. Can you do orthopedic oncology on telemedicine? I'm sure you can do consults and stuff, right?
Yeah, I would say that the advancement of telemedicine has been the single biggest change in most of our practices, and especially my practice. Much of my medical decision-making is based around radiological imaging. And so prior to the pandemic, I was not really empowered to call someone up and say, Ms. Jones, your imaging shows a benign tumor. I think we can re-image this. We don't need to biopsy it. And the changes in the rules around telemedicine has made that much more acceptable.
And easier, I imagine, for patients and for you.
Yes. Our institution has leaned heavily into telemedicine. And to put some numbers on that, prior to the pandemic, with about 7,000 outpatient clinic visits per day, we had 8 to 10 total telemedicine visits per day. So about 0.1%. And at the pandemic peak, we topped out at 2,600 per day. And we have now reached an equilibrium somewhere in the 700 range. And so about for our primary rural center, we're at about 12% telemedicine, and the country remains at about 9%.
Okay, so this one's a little sideways, but roll with me here. You are a person of science, right? You are trained in the sciences, yet which is required for your job. Yet your job also requires you to interact with people at what may well be the worst day of their lives. How do you do that?
Yeah, I think that's true of so many people in medicine. Whether the patient has an obvious cancer or not, you need to understand that by being referred to see me, that that alone causes an extreme amount of anxiety. And so 90% of my job is talking people off the ledge and telling them they don't need to be there. But you're right. It's it requires empathy, and that is not necessarily in the textbooks for medical school.
Can you leave it at the office or no?
No, it's not. It's not possible to leave it at the office. I don't know anyone who can. But I think that that trying to leave it at the office would be a mistake.
Why so?
Well, I mean, the surgeries that I do require oftentimes weeks of planning. I actually called the patient recently. His surgery was the following week, and I was home with the kids and had an idea Saturday morning about how we could change things up from what we had talked about. And I called him up at home and said, you know, hey, Mr. Smith, you know, sorry to surprise you, but I just had this idea. I know your surgery is Monday morning. I want to run this by you, and we made a change, and it worked out. So you can't turn it off.
Without casting aspersions on Dartmouth at all, if you could be in practice in Boston or Seattle or Los Angeles, would you give up the rural part of this job?
Well, I can tell you I've had that opportunity, and you know, so far I really love where I am. Out my back door window, I can see mountains 30 miles away and watch the sunset rise over them. And, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, because the greatest things about living where we live are also the things which make practicing medicine here the most difficult. We live in one of the most beautiful areas in the country. And yet, because of the ruralness, which makes it beautiful, we have more trouble staffing and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Dr. Eric Anderson, he's at Dartmouth, where he does orthopedic oncology. Dr. Anderson, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Oil is going to be in the news tomorrow. OPEC is set to release its monthly oil market report, the state of things, basically, with some forecasts of where the global crude market might be headed. The backdrop is last month's decision by the cartel to cut production by about 1 million barrels a day. That kind of caught crude watchers by surprise and helped send oil to its highs for the year. You fast forward to today, though, and prices are kind of back down to where they were at the beginning of April. Marketplace's Lily Jamali covers energy for us.
OPEC and its allies, which together make up OPEC Plus, were hoping for a pop in oil prices that would last longer than a few weeks, says David Fife, chief economist for Argus Media.
Members must be sort of scratching their head and wondering what exactly they have to do to put in place a sort of solid floor for prices.
Russia has played a role in keeping oil prices down, Fife says. Western allies have tried to limit how much money Russia can get for its oil without taking it out of the market completely. And so,
both Russian crude oil exports and refined products exports are very robust.
That's a dilemma for OPEC nations, says Clark Williams Derry of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
When oil prices go too low, they start running fiscal deficits. A lot of these nations really depend on oil revenue to balance their national budgets.
Oil prices are hovering in the low to mid $70 a barrel range. The IMF says Saudi Arabia, for one, needs oil prices up around $80 a barrel to break even.
But $80 per barrel oil is actually high enough to create demand destruction.
That is, consumers will buy less. And in a world transitioning to green energy, there's no guarantee lost demand for oil will come back. Demand does seem to be softening because of the global economy, says Pavel Molchanov of Raymond James, a marketplace underwriter. The world's major central banks are still trying to deal with persistent inflation
all of them have been raising rates. That is slowing the economy. When the economy slows, oil demand naturally is affected.
And oil prices could remain stuck no matter what other surprises OPEC has up its sleeve. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Coming up,
he had to clean some things up on his credit, and he did it.
Which is amazing, because that is not easy. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 30 points today, about a 10%, 33,531. The NASDAQ climbed 126 points, a bit more than 1% there, 12,306. S&P 500, 18 points to the good, 0.4%, 41.37. Sabrina was talking about how stores are trying to persuade consumers to keep on spending, fatigue or no. So how about some retail stocks, eh? Macy's slid 1.4%. The online giant Amazon gained 3.3%. Supplier of all things pet-related, Petco, climbed 2.1%. Ticker for that one? Anybody? Come on. It's an all-timer. W-O-O-F. Airbnb signaled this morning that bookings and earnings might decline this year, especially compared to last, when pent-up demand boosted travel spending. As we all know, Airbnb shares down 10.9%. Bonds up, yields down 3.43%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this: it's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks, where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, back to this morning's news on inflation, 4.9% year over year, as we said. If you scroll down in the report, though, past all the goods, the stuff, the coffee and clocks and sewing machines, you get to a category called services less energy services. That is the price of everything you buy that's not a physical thing, excluding, just like it said, energy services. You can think electricity there, right? And that number is significantly higher than the headline figure, up 6.8% since last year. But riddle me this, would you? Inflation overall is coming down pretty steadily, right? But why are service prices still so stubbornly high? Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes looked into that one.
Economist Alan Detmeister has ants, which he was dealing with when he talked with me today. Or rather, he'd hired someone to deal with them.
I apologize. I think my exterminator just locked himself out.
The exterminator services would likely fall under what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls household operations, a category where prices have increased 8% since last year. Also up, veterinary services 10%, car insurance up more than 15%. Dentmeister, who works for UBS, by the way, says inflation for all services tends to be slow to change, partly because they're related to how much we pay exterminators and insurers and vet technicians.
Wages are a big part of services prices. And wages are often changed, usually only once a year. Services prices are changed much less frequently than goods prices.
Core service inflation is starting to decelerate. It's down from 7.3% in February, which was the highest it had been in more than four decades. But it's still got a long way to go, points out BlackRock investment strategist Gargi Chaudhry.
If you looked at the pre-pandemic world, services inflation was somewhere around, call it 2.5%, give or take. So we've certainly moved significantly higher.
The other big factor keeping service inflation high is housing. Yes, housing or shelter is considered a service, even if you own your home. And there's a shortage of it, which has driven prices up. Robert Frick is a corporate economist with the Navy Federal Credit Union.
We don't have enough shelters to go around. You know, if we'd known then what we know now, we would have built a lot more houses starting 10 years ago.
Frick also says service inflation isn't equally distributed and that it can hit lower income households particularly hard. For example, they're more likely to own a used car.
And it's an older model car, which requires more repairs, and you are paying extremely high rates to get those cars repaired.
Extremely high is right. Motor vehicle repairs were up 20% in April from last year. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
You've heard of food deserts, right? Those places in this economy where people can't get affordable, nutritious food. There is a financial equivalent of sorts. They're called credit deserts, where people with shaky financial histories can't get affordable credit or perhaps are even ineligible for home or business loans at traditional banks. For places like that, there are community development financial institutions certified by the Treasury Department with access to special funding and other kinds of assistance. There are 1,400 or so banks and credit unions designated as CDFIs. And this year, Treasury is tightening up on that certification process to make sure those institutions are actually lending into underserved markets. But banks that serve Native communities say that could undermine their work. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
Joshua Ironshell spent 18 years working for construction companies before he reached a breaking point. He was on a roof in Lincoln, Nebraska, installing gutters. It was about 100 degrees out.
I'm like, I'm making all this money for these other companies. I need to be making this money for myself, you know, and my family.
He'd been toying with the idea of starting his own roofing business for a while.
My whole extended family, like, they had to listen to me for years about getting a gutter machine.
A gutter machine shapes sheet metal into, you guessed it, gutters.
Like, all I need is a gutter machine.
Plus a trailer and some ladders, about a $25,000 investment. And Josh couldn't just walk into any bank and ask for a loan.
Coming from where I came from, I didn't even value having a bank account, let alone a credit score.
Josh grew up on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota, where at the time, he says, there wasn't a lot of commerce. He didn't know any Native business owners.
There was really nobody to model or to look up to.
Except this one Native guy he knew named Pete, who ran a loan fund. So there Josh was on the roof, in the heat. He sent Pete a video.
Still out here killing these gutters, Pete. I haven't lost hope of my dream of owning my own gutter machine and trailer.
He said, I want to open my own business. Tell me what I need to do.
That's Pete Upton, director of the Native 360 Loan Fund. He says Josh was like a lot of his clients. Lots of talent and drive, but a less than stellar financial history.
He had to clean some things up on his credit, and he did it.
Within a year, Native 360 got him that $25,000 loan. And 4 years later,
he's one of the most successful roofers in the region.
Upton also directs the Native CDFI Network, It represents 88 financial institutions focused on growing tribal economies and helping Native families build generational wealth. More than 60 of them are certified as CDFIs, but some are worried that they'll lose that status after seeing a preview of Treasury's updated requirements.
When we first heard about it, you know, naturally, a lot of fear generated throughout the community of what could happen if all these went through.
Upton is most worried about a proposed ban on CDFIs offering certain financial products, like interest-only loans and mortgages with terms of longer than 30 years. Noel Poyo works on community economic development programs at Treasury. He says it's trying to ensure that CDFIs are actually filling gaps in underserved communities.
Being more clear about what that value is and how you meet that standard is what we are trying to do.
Poyo says Treasury is trying to restrict the use of loan products that are sometimes seen as predatory, but it's considering comments from Native-serving banks saying those types of loans are important for boosting home and business ownership in tribal communities.
And I challenge anyone to find me a harder-to-serve market than many reservations in this country.
Joshua Pape knows all about that. He's COO of Chickasaw Community Bank, a Native CDFI in Oklahoma City that uses extended-term mortgages as a last resort for borrowers with especially poor credit. If the new rule goes into effect without changes, Pape says his bank could lose its CDFI status.
We would not stop serving Native Americans. That would not change at all. What would stop, though, is our ability to receive certain types of grants.
Grants that help fund Chickasaw Community Bank's operations and things like its down payment assistance program. Pete Upton with the Native CDFI Network is confident that Treasury is taking these concerns seriously. When the new certification rules are finalized this fall,
what we're hoping is they come to a compromise with us.
In a lot of rural tribal communities, Upton says Native CDFIs are the only bridge to traditional financing for clients like Joshua Ironshell.
Yeah, they gave me a shot when I had no credit.
Josh's credit score is in better shape now. He has plans to expand his business, called The Gutter Connection, to offer other construction services. And this time, he says getting a loan won't be so hard. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just to start to quantify exactly how bad a breach of the debt limit or even coming close to it would be, because it would be bad, full stop. You can just say that out loud. Moody's Analytics is out with some new projections of jobs lost per state if House Republicans decide to drive the government into not paying what we owe. Texas, 561,000 jobs lost if a debt limit breach drags on. Florida, 474,000. Ohio, 296,000 jobs gone. You get the picture. It would be not good. Full stop. All right, here is your moment of economic context on the way out. One last gasp on inflation with the observation that those higher prices we're all seeing are a global phenomenon. The International Monetary Fund is out with some data on commodities. Of note, and of interest to me, because we eat a lot of this in my house, we use a lot, olive oil. Prices are at a 26-year high, due mostly to a drought in Spain, which is, by the way, the world's biggest olive oil producer. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Tirado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.